Welcome to the Freedom Trail Podcast, brought to you by the Freedom Trail Foundation and the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Episode 2, Paul Revere's Ride, featuring Paul Revere at Gunpoint, an audio play performed by the Freedom Trail Players. Also, an interview with historian and author Jane Triber on the life of Paul Revere, and a conversation with Emily Holmes, Education Director of the Paul Revere House. Part 1, Paul Revere at Gunpoint.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year.
Sound familiar? These words comprise the opening stanza of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, Paul Revere's Ride, written just prior to America's Civil War. The immensely popular poem forever fixed the midnight ride in the public consciousness. And yet, even though Longfellow's poem dramatically changed the way we view revolutionary history, for example, the Midnight Ride was not considered important enough to merit a mention in Revere's obituary some 40 years before the poem was published, Paul Revere's Ride is an inaccurate source of revolutionary history. Longfellow, adding Paul Revere to his canon of folk heroes that included Hiawatha and Miles Standish, was perhaps more concerned with creating an American legend than a strict adherence to the facts. Consider the following passage.
It was 2 by the village clock when he came to the bridge in Concord town. He heard the bleating of the flock and the twitter of birds among the trees, and felt the breath of the morning breeze blowing over the meadow brown. And one was safe and asleep in his bed, who at the bridge would be first to fall, who that day would be lying dead, pierced by a British musket ball.
One might reasonably assume by reading this that Paul Revere rode to Lexington and Concord on the night of the midnight ride. But it would be a mistake to do so, for Paul never made it to Concord. He was arrested by a redcoat patrol in between Lexington and Concord. But just as Mark Twain observed, the truth is stranger and frequently more interesting than fiction. And the circumstances of Paul Revere's captivity by redcoats are as dramatic as any poetic device that Longfellow might have invented. The following audio play is a dramatization of the events of the Midnight Ride, principally drawn from a far more reliable source, Paul Revere's own accounts of the ride. On the afternoon of April 18th, 1775, as the shadows lengthened into evening, a stable boy told Paul Revere of a rumor he had heard from a hustler at a Boston livery stable.
Mr. Revere, Mr. Revere, the regulars prepare to march. A friend of mine from the stables saw several officers work their riding tax. He heard them say there will be hell to pay tomorrow, sir.
You are the third person who has brought me the same information.
There had been signs all around town of the impending troop movement. Longboats moored alongside the HMS Somerset and the HMS Boyne were the focus of furious activity around Boston Harbor. Soldiers were spotted around town with their accoutrements on. Frederick Mackenzie, of His Majesty's Royal Welch Fusiliers, recorded in his diary that the plans of the Redcoats were common knowledge.
The town was a good deal agitated and alarmed at this movement, as it was generally known by means of seamen who came on shore from their ships about 2 o'clock that the boats were ordered to be in readiness.
Since most of the Whig leaders had left Boston, Dr. Joseph Warren, the senior of those who remained, was obliged to become something of a spy master, collecting rumors and alarms of British movements, assessing their validity, and reacting. On this day, confronted with reports that multiplied as the hours went by, Warren conferred with his most confidential informant to confirm that the long-prepared-for major movement had indeed come at last. The true identity of Warren's agent is one that he carried to his grave and has been a subject of much speculation and conjecture. There is strong circumstantial evidence to suggest that the shadowy figure might be none other than Commanding General Thomas Gage's American wife, Margaret Kemble Gage. A woman whose loyalties were divided between obligations to her homeland and her marriage, Margaret spoke openly of her distress to friends.
I hope that my husband will never be the instrument of sacrificing the lives of my countrymen. My feelings are those of the Lady Blanche in Shakespeare's King John. The sun's o'ercast with blood. Fair day, adieu. Which is the side that I must go with all? I am with both. Each army hath a hand. And in their rage, I, having hold of both, they swirl asunder and dismember me. Husband, I cannot pray that thou mayst win. Uncle, I needs must pray that thou mayst lose. Father, I may not wish the fortune thine. Grandam, I will not wish thy fortunes thrive. Whoever wins, on that side shall I lose. Assured loss before the match be played.
When Gage's subordinate, Lord Percy, told him that the plan to march on Lexington was common knowledge, Percy remembered that he became quite agitated and cried,
My confidence has been betrayed, for I communicated my design to one person only.
Shortly thereafter, Margaret Kemble Gage was sent across the sea to England by her husband, never to return to the land of her birth. We will likely never know whether Margaret was Warren's source or not, but we do know that he didn't hesitate to act on the information that he received. He wasted no time in calling Paul Revere before him.
Sir, you must go to Lexington and inform Mr. Samuel Adams and the Honorable John Hancock, Esquire, that there is a number of soldiers composed of light troops and grenadiers marching to the bottom of the common, where here there are a number of boats to receive them. It is supposed they are going to Lexington by way of the Cambridge River to take them, and perhaps then to Concord to destroy the colony stores. I beg you leave at once and acquaint them of this movement of which they are the object.
Sir, I shall proceed immediately.
Revere stopped briefly at the house of sexton Robert Newman to arrange for the hanging of lanterns in the old North Church steeple, a planned signal in case his attempt to escape Boston was unsuccessful. He was then rowed across the Charles River, too close to the HMS Somerset for comfort. Upon landing at Charlestown Battery, Revere was met by the town patriot leaders and received a warning from Richard Devons, Esquire.
Be careful, sir. This very evening after sunset, I met 9 officers of Gage's army, well mounted and armed, going towards Concord.
Revere was given a fine horse by Deacon Larkin and began his ride. On the Lexington Road, he was spotted and pursued by 2 redcoat pickets on horseback, but managed to elude them. After much hard riding, he reached the door of Reverend Jonas Clark.
Sir, the family has just retired and requested that they might not be disturbed by any noise about the house.
Noise? You'll have noise enough before long. The regulars are coming out.
Come in, Revere. We're not afraid of you.
Revere conferred with John Hancock and Samuel Adams within, delivering the warning he had been charged with. They were shortly joined at the Clark House by his fellow courier, William Dawes, sent by Dr. Warren along a different route. Their primary mission achieved, the two decided to continue to Concord. On their way, they were met by Dr. Samuel Prescott, a patriot from Concord, who offered to assist them in their efforts to spread the alarm there. Shortly thereafter, the three were spotted by 3 mounted redcoats bearing sword and pistol.
God damn you, stop! You go an inch further, you are a dead man. Turn in that pasture or blow your brains out.
Put on.
Stop! Stop!
Prescott and Dawes managed to escape the redcoat horsemen. Revere was not so lucky. Heading towards a copse at the bottom of the pasture, he was confronted by 6 more horsemen. They seized the reins from the startled Revere and pointed pistols at his breast. The interrogation of Paul Revere began.
You will dismount, sir.
Where have you come from?
From Boston.
Sir, may I crave your name?
My name is Revere.
What? Paul Revere?
Yes.
Be not afraid. No one shall hurt you.
I am not afraid, for you will miss your aim.
What? We shall not. We were only waiting for some deserters down the road. We expect you,
I know better, sir. I know better. I know what you are after, and I have alarmed the country all the way up. I know that your boats caught aground in the river, and when they land, I shall have 500 men to meet them.
We shall have 1,500 coming, sir.
I tell you, your lives are at risk if you linger here. If I had not known people had been sent out to give information to the country and time enough to get 50 miles, I would have ventured one shot from you before I had suffered you to stop me.
Despite their bravado, the officers couldn't hide their dismay at Revere's words. One of them rode back up to the road and returned with his commanding officer, Major Mitchell, who promptly clapped his pistol to Revere's temple.
Now, sir, I am going to ask you some questions, and if you do not answer truthfully, I will blow your brains out.
I esteem myself a man of truth. You have stopped me on the highway and made me a prisoner. I know not by what right, but I will tell you the truth, for I am not afraid.
And so the process of interrogation was repeated, with Revere standing by his earlier words. His coolness under interrogation was impressive, masking his intent of keeping the soldiers away from Lexington, where Hancock and Adams lingered. He had managed to delay them for some hours before the party again began to move towards Lexington.
By God, sir, you are not to ride with reins. Here, you lead him.
Let me have the reins. I will not run from you.
I would not trust you. Bring out the others. We are now going towards your friends. If you attempt to run, or if we are insulted, we will blow your brains out. Sergeant, keep your pistol on him, and if he runs, execute my sentence.
You may do as you please.
Revere was added to a group of prisoners the Redcoats had taken from the roads. He continued to be the target of verbal intimidation from his captors.
Damned rebel!
You are in a damned critical situation, sir.
I am sensible of it.
About a half mile from Lexington, the air was split with the sound of a musket shot.
What was that for?
To alarm the country.
This was shortly followed by the great boom of a volley of musketry. And then, in the distance, the ringing of the Lexington town bell. Revere's fellow captive, Jonathan Loring, taunted the Redcoats.
The bells are ringing, the town's alarmed, and you're all dead men.
Suddenly, Revere's threats seemed more plausible to the Redcoats, who decided to abandon their captives.
You four, get off your horses.
Will you not dismiss me as well?
Sergeant, is your horse tired?
Worn out, sir.
Revere, we will make use of your horse for the night. Your ride is over.
The Redcoats thundered off, leaving Revere to walk back to Lexington. He never saw Deacon Larkin's excellent mare again, often referred to as Brown Beauty. The horse that had served Paul Revere so well that night was reportedly ridden to death by the Redcoats that had taken her. Revere was back in Lexington in time to spur the escape of the dallying Adams and Hancock and see the first shots fired at the green. Debunkers have long seized upon Revere's capture to try and undo the legend-making of Longfellow's famous poem, but an examination of record reveals that unlike many heroes of folklore, Paul Revere remains heroic when stripped of the trappings of myth and legend. He may not have written to both Lexington and Concord, but his interrogation at gunpoint can be deemed no less interesting, and his conduct under interrogation, defiant, proud, unwilling to defer, and secretly shrewd, mark him as a patriot worthy of the legend that was later applied to him.
So through the night rode Paul Revere, and so through the night went his cry of alarm to every Middlesex village and farm, a cry of defiance and not of fear, a voice in the darkness, a knock at the door, a word that shall echo forevermore. For born on the night wind of the past, through all our history to the last, in the hour of darkness and peril and need, the people will waken and listen to hear the hurrying hoofbeat of that steed and the midnight message of Paul Revere.
Part 2. An interview with Jane Triber, historian and author of A True Republican, The Life of Paul Revere. Thanks for speaking with us today, Jane. We're going to start off with just some basic information about Paul Revere. Paul Revere has become something of an American folk hero due to his role in the Midnight Ride, but who was Paul Revere in the years that led up to 1775?
He was a successful master artisan. We call him a silversmith. He used the term goldsmith. He was a very well-respected member of his community. A man of middling rank, as he would have said, somebody who was ambitious and was starting to rise in the world until the 1760s, when the Stamp Act had economic repercussions that seemed to kind of thwart his continued hopes of rising in the world.
Now, you mentioned middling. What is a middling rank? Like,
they didn't use the term classes. We would say middle class. They used the term a man of middling ranks. If you look at artisans, He was at the top of the hierarchy of artisans. He was a master goldsmith, which is a very skilled and artistic trade. He was a laborer in one sense. It required a great deal of strength to hammer silver, but he was also an artist. But in the overall society, an artisan was a man in the middle. He had little formal education. He probably went to a school called a writing school, learned to read and write, enough education to run a business. He didn't go to Harvard. He wasn't a gentleman who spent hours in his book-lined study. He was a man who worked with his hands for a living, but he was a very respected artisan in the community.
And how would better-educated people and higher-class people deal with somebody like Paul Revere?
They were probably his customers. His friends, his Masonic Lodge brothers, were people like himself. They were artisans. They were small shopkeepers. Most of the upper classes, people who were lawyers and merchants, may have been his customers, but he wasn't socializing with them.
And so we're not seeing him in a bar with John Hancock.
Oh, no, definitely not. See, that's the major misconception. Americans don't like to think that we've ever had a class society. And I think it would have been equally uncomfortable for both men to socialize with each other. They came from different worlds.
You wrote a biography about Paul Revere called A True Republican, The Life of Paul Revere. Why did you call it A True Republican? What does that mean?
It actually comes from a letter. He had a friend who was living in England, and he had a nephew who had gotten into all sorts of trouble running around with the wrong crowd. And the friend wrote to Revere asking him to take his nephew under his wing. You know, Revere had a large family, so he thought he could talk to him as a father. But then he said he wanted Revere to make his nephew a true Republican like Paul Revere, a man of honor and integrity. The term Republican is not the capital R Republican, as in today, Republicans and Democrats. It's small R Republican. It was a form of government and society in which they believed that people should sacrifice their private, selfish interest to the public good. It's somewhat of an idealistic point of view. And he thought that Revere was a man of honor and integrity and virtue, a man who devoted himself to the larger public good. And he hoped that Revere could kind of take this wayward nephew and instill in him some of those virtues.
And how common was that kind of ideology of smaller republicanism in the 18th century?
Well, that was the guiding ideology of the Patriot Movement, the Sons of Liberty. They believed that they were creating a republican government, and not just a government, but a republican society. In a royal society or a monarchy, it was a very hierarchical society in which people knew their place in the world. In a republican society, they thought, I would say, more horizontally than vertically. In other words, they still had differences in social ranks and so forth, but it was a belief that you would have a government based on the consent of the governed, that people would elect representatives to express their point of views. But it also was a social ideology. I think they felt, and it's kind of an exhilarating and idealistic view, that they could create a new sort of society in which people like Paul Revere could very well rise in the world based not on who their parents were, but on their own innate talent and virtue. And it is somewhat of an idealistic notion. And we still feel today, I think, that this is the guiding ideology in our society, that we can rise in the world based on hard work and our own talents.
You mentioned who people aren't going to be judged by who their parents are. Who are Paul Revere's parents?
His father was born Apollos Revoir. He was a French Huguenot or Protestant who came to Boston as a 15-year-old boy, was apprenticed to a silversmith, and he anglicized his name to Paul Revere, as he said, on account of the country bumpkins couldn't pronounce his name. He was a very good silversmith. He married into the Hitchborn family. Deborah Hitchborn was from a very numerous family in the north end of Boston. Her people were mariners, shipbuilders, boatwrights. So I think Paul Revere's father was kind of outnumbered by his wife's family.
And you mentioned his being French, and I find that's a thing that people are always kind of surprised about. One of the great founding fathers is the son of a Frenchman. What is the relationship between French people and English people in the colonial period?
It's somewhat complicated by the fact that his father was a French Protestant, mm-hmm. not a French Catholic. The Huguenots, many of them fled France to find religious freedom in then the colonies, now the United States. France was traditionally the arch enemy of England, so Revere would have grown up as a boy thinking of France as the enemy. Until the Revolutionary War, then, when they became our allies. And he actually writes a letter to a cousin saying how he had to change his point of view now that he actually met some of them. He never spoke French. He corresponded with a French cousin, and someone had to translate the letters. He never visited France either. So it's hard to say. In Esther Forbes' biography of Paul Revere, she suggests that Revere's love of liberty was kind of an inheritance from his father's background. The French Huguenots left France to find religious liberty. I mean, you can't really prove that, but it's possible he grew up hearing stories about the importance of liberty because his father's forebears did not have liberty.
So let's get into the part where Paul Revere gets famous in our eyes. Paul Revere is famous for the Midnight Ride on April 18th, 1775, but people mostly know that because of the poem by Longfellow, and there are some misconceptions in that poem. So what happened, and what are the misconceptions? How did we get there?
First of all, I don't want to blame Longfellow. I worked at Longfellow's house many years ago. Longfellow was trying to use Revere as an archetype of the revolutionary spirit of liberty and independence, and he was very aware that he took liberty. I think the major misconceptions are, first of all, that the Midnight Ride was the impulsive act of one man who leaped out of bed in the middle of the night. I actually used to do this with a slideshow, showing Revere jumping out of a bed. That Revere raced around the countryside yelling, "The British are coming," to sort of arouse his countrymen. When, in fact, the real Midnight Ride was the end result of months of careful intelligence gathering by Revere, who was an experienced a courier. He had been carrying news since December of 1773, when he carried news of the Boston Tea Party to New York. And thereafter, he was a regular rider between Boston and the Continental Congress, where he carried news from Boston, delivered it to members of the Continental Congress, and stopped at colonies along the way. And on the way back, he brought information from the Continental Congress. The Midnight Ride was the most famous of many rides by Paul Revere. The ride was also the result of careful intelligence gathering by Paul Revere and a network of artisans and mechanics, as they called themselves. Starting in the winter of 74, Revere and about 30 of these men patrolled the streets every night after work, spying on the British. It wasn't exactly a secret that the British were probably planning some expedition in the countryside, so they were trying to figure out what the objective would be. And in Revere's own three accounts of the ride, he explains, "On the 15th of April, they noticed suspicious activity. The troops were taken off routine patrol. The transports, or smaller boats, were being hauled up under warships. So it looked like they were getting boats ready to transport troops." And Revere said, "From these movements, we expected something serious was to be transacted. The most likely object was either the arrest of Patriot leaders John Hancock and Samuel Adams, who were in Lexington, or the British were going after the colony stores of gunpowder in Concord." Based on this, Dr. Joseph Warren, who was actually one of the Patriot leaders, sent Revere to Lexington first on April the 16th. This is a ride that most people don't know about. It was a leisurely Sunday ride to Lexington. Revere delivered his news to Hancock and Adams to be prepared that something was going to happen soon. He doesn't say whether he himself rode to Concord that day, but he forwarded the news to Concord, so the munitions were already being moved before the British arrived. Now, Revere had, and I think this is what interests me, is this is a man who was level-headed and cool and very ingenious in coming up with plans. He was concerned that he wouldn't be able to get out of Boston. He had to get across the Charles River past a British warship. If another rider was sent by a land route, he had to get past a guard on Boston Neck. Boston was a peninsula, and there was just a small neck of land. So Revere made arrangements with a group of patriots in Charlestown that he would have lantern signals hung from the steeple of the North Church. And this is Longfellow's major mistake, the second mistake. It wasn't a ride to every Middlesex village and farm, and Revere was not nervously pacing back and forth, gazing up at the steeple of the church. He arranged with the Charlestown patriots that he would have lantern signals hung. One if the British went out over the Charles, two if they went by the land route, and it was actually a group of Charlestown patriots led by Colonel William Conant who would look to the steeple of the church. Their job was to send another rider from Charlestown. So if Revere never got across the river, and if another rider never left by land, another rider would be sent from Charlestown. So everything was very carefully planned and thought out. Revere went home to wait until the British made their move. On the 18th of April, the famous ride that we all know about, everyone in Boston knew that the British were doing something. Dr. Warren got word from several people that the troops were assembling on the common getting into their boats. And Revere writes in his accounts, "Dr. Warren sent for me in great haste about 10 p.m., and I found he had sent another messenger by land, a Mr. William Dawes." Revere got across the Charles. He was met by the Charlestown Patriots, who told him that they had seen the signals and dispatched a rider from Charlestown, a man whose name is not known to history. Revere then went to borrow a horse from, he did not have a horse with him because it's a little hard to get across the Charles River on horseback. He borrowed a horse in Charlestown and set off. Quickly, early on in the ride, a British patrol spotted him, and he had a faster horse, and he got away. And he said he alarmed every house until he got to Lexington. He arrived at Lexington. John Hancock and Samuel Adams were staying at a parsonage. And earlier in the evening, word was received that British patrols were seen on the road. So a Sergeant William Monroe and a group of troops were guarding the entrance to the home. And they said, Revere came up, you know, galloping up, jumping off the horse, making a great deal of noise. And Sergeant Monroe said, the family has requested that there be no noise, so they've gone to sleep. And Revere supposedly replied, noise? You'll have noise enough before long. The regulars are out. But a half an hour later, William Dawes arrived, and Revere writes, we refreshed ourselves. Their assignment was very specific. They were only instructed to ride to Lexington, to the parsonage of Reverend Jonas Clark, and inform Hancock and Adams the King's troops have left Boston. They were done. But they decided on their own it might not be a bad idea to continue on to Concord and carry a warning there. On the road, they were overtaken by Dr. Samuel Prescott. Revere writes, we found him to be a high son of liberty. Dr. Prescott, ironically, was not out for patriotic reasons. He had been visiting his girlfriend and was on his way home. When he encountered them and they determined who he was, he said he offered to help them, thinking people would believe the news because they knew him. Prescott was from Concord. All three men set off for Concord, but halfway there, they were intercepted by a British patrol. According to the accounts, Revere says that Dawes made a break for it. He jumped his horse over a stone wall, and he got away. He did not get to Concord, as far as anyone knows. There are a number of family stories about what he did. Prescott got away, and he's the only one who got to Concord. Revere was stopped by the soldiers, held at gunpoint. They said, stop, God damn you, if you go an inch further, you are a dead man. And they asked his name, and he said, Revere. They said, what, Paul Revere? And he writes, they abused much. And they said to him, they asked him what his mission was, and if he didn't tell the truth, they would blow his brains out. And this is my favorite part of the ride. Here's Revere held at gunpoint. He's told, tell the truth or we will kill you, basically. He looks at them and tells a bald-faced lie. He said, you have missed your aim. I have alarmed the country all the way up. I should have 500 men there soon. There are approximately 70 farmers at Lexington Green pacing around wondering where the heck the British soldiers were. So they got scared. He unnerved them, thoroughly unnerved them. They think they're on a secret mission, and Revere tells them basically the entire countryside knows. So they decide they better head back to Lexington, taking Revere as a prisoner, along with several other men they had stopped earlier in the evening. They headed back to Lexington. They released Revere within sight of the meeting house, and first they took his horse and exchanged it for a tired horse of one of their soldiers. And Revere arrived just in time to see the King's troops arriving, and he heard the first gunshot of the American Revolution.
So since there's other folks out there, there's other riders, how significant is Paul Revere specifically to this night? Would word have gotten out properly without him being around?
David Fisher, who's written a book on Paul Revere's ride, estimates more than 60 riders were delivering news. What Revere would do, for example, if he would stop at the home of the Medford Minuteman, which he did, the Medford Minuteman Captain Isaac Hall would then dispatch a rider from there to alarm the men, the rest of the men in his regiment. There's a balance here. Revere is very important in the sense that his ingenuity and his coolness under fire, where he's held by the British, he tells them he's alarmed the whole countryside, illustrate that he had certain qualities that made him very important. On the other hand, it's important to stress he was a part of a network of people who very carefully planned and executed an intelligence assignment. William Dawes is not as famous as Paul Revere, but he was able to get past a guard at Boston Neck. There are various stories. He sometimes would use the pose of a drunken country farmer, slouched in the saddle, and the soldiers would just kind of laugh and wave him on. Another account says basically he passed with a group of other people, and they didn't really notice him. So he also had certain skills where he could talk his way out of a situation. So there were other people who were equally important. So there is a balance of giving Revere his due, but also realizing that there are other people who played important roles and carried out their roles very, very effectively that night.
We're going to keep giving Paul Revere his due here. Paul Revere makes ultimately becomes very famous because of this midnight ride. How famous was he then?
In his own lifetime, I always used to use the term, he was a respected pillar of the community. In his obituary, it talks about his services during the revolutionary drama as well as a later date in the progress of our metropolis. He wasn't singled out specifically for the Midnight Ride. He was known for his earliest services going back to the Stamp Act crisis in 1765. He was a well-known son of liberty. He was also known for his success in business. Most people know him as a silversmith, but after the Revolution, he had a hardware store. He also made bells and cannon. He was very proud of his work providing cannons to the United States Army so that his country didn't have to import material from England. And the crowning achievement professionally was he actually is the founder of the first successful copper rolling mill in the United States. He provided copper for the USS Constitution, the dome of the new State House in Boston, and he was exceedingly proud of that work. So he was known for that. And other qualities people mention, which I found interesting, they talk about his opinions, his advice, which people turned to him for advice. He was considered somebody who was a man of good judgment and highly respected. His midnight ride was known. In 1798, the Massachusetts Historical Society asked Revere to provide any information on his role during the Revolution. And he was quite proud of that. He wrote, "I am providing some facts and anecdotes about the American Revolution, which I do not recall to have seen in any history." So he felt that he could provide a unique point of view. So that account was published in the Mass Historical Society in 1798. So certainly people were aware of it. But he was known in general as a well-respected member of the community, member of committees. He was Grand Master of the Masonic Lodge, the highest office you can hold. But he was not known specifically for just the Midnight Ride.
And didn't end up doing much in the public sphere as far as public office is concerned.
Because this is when I teach history, I always tell my students to go to the Museum of Fine Arts and look at the Copley portrait of Paul Revere. You don't pick it up in the reproductions, but if you look at the original portrait, Paul Revere's fingernails are broken and dirty. Mm-hmm. They're the hands of a working man. So because of that, because he lacked a genteel education and refinement, he was not going to become a mayor of Boston. He did serve on some town meeting committees. During the Revolutionary period, he held minor offices. After the Revolution, he was a leader. When it came time to ratify the United States Constitution, he was considered one of the leaders of the artisans in Boston who supported the Constitution. They thought a stronger federal government and tariff policy would improve the economy, would be good for artisans and small merchants. So he was in charge of that committee. But he did not hold a high political office.
I'm just curious about this. You mentioned his being kind of a working class guy and dirty fingers. There's a lot of conversation about wigs out on the Freedom Trail. Would Paul Revere be a guy who wears a wig?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
It's a very complicated, it's like if you look at artisans, if you compare Revere, a master goldsmith or silversmith, to a guy who makes barrels, Revere's trade is much more prestigious. He would make more money. I use the term in my book that he's a bridge between the world of artisans and gentlemen. His customers are fellow artisans for whom he made things like shoe and knee buckles and buttons. Mm-hmm. But at the other range of the scale, his customers are merchants and ship captains, and they buy things like tea sets and coffee sets. So he kind of moved between the world of working class people and artisans. And also as a master artisan, he's a small businessman. He employs people, he hires people, he pays them, he keeps his books, he fires them. He has to keep order among his apprentices and the journeymen. So it's very much a bridge. He's an elite among artisans, but in the overall social structure, he's very much a man in the middle of his society.
Why is Paul Revere still important to people today?
Well, I think the way Longfellow depicted him was, I think Longfellow was very much saddened by the slavery crisis in 1851, for example, when the fugitive slave Thomas Sims was arrested in Boston and returned down south. Longfellow writes in his journal, "Shame that this great republic should stoop to be the refuge of slave catchers." And Longfellow used Paul Revere as a symbol of what America is supposed to be, the ideals of liberty and honor, and also the belief that one individual, one person can stand up and do the right thing. And I think that's still important to Americans today, that people have to stand up for their principles. So even though Longfellow distorted specific facts, he got a lot of right about Paul Revere. Paul Revere was a man of principle, a man of honor, a man of action, a man who fought for his beliefs. Sometimes with his fists, he can be somewhat abrasive. And I think that's something that Americans feel is still part of our culture. Like we believe one vote can make a difference, for example. And we believe that one person can stand up and speak out and make a difference. It's something kids learn in school. So I think that makes Revere very much still a relevant figure in American history.
You mentioned, so now I gotta ask, he uses fists sometimes.
There's kind of a funny story. In the 1760s, he was hauled into court. He got into a fight with a guy who was married to his cousin. It's not clear what the fight was about. So Revere, he was found somewhat culpable and he had to pay court costs, but the man who paid the court costs for him was the brother of the guy he got in the fight with. To this day, it's not clear what the fight was about. So the reason I mentioned it in the book was I think in one way it would have given him status among the artisans and laborers on the waterfront that, hey, he's not going to take any, he's a tough guy, he can stand up for himself. On the other hand, as a Mason, he learned to be a little bit more genteel. In the Masonic halls, he would have, as a master of his lodge, he would have to learn how to keep order. So it allows him, I think, he's a very important figure because he can move between these two, the rough and tumble world of the waterfront brawlers, but he also can move in the world of more restrained people who can lead in their society, who can control subordinates, whether it's his unruly apprentices or Masons, that he can keep order in his lodge.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Treiber. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jane Treiber is the author of A True Republican, The Life of Paul Revere. Part 3, a conversation with Emily Holmes, Education Director of the Paul Revere House. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
Thank you for coming to visit me.
So Paul Revere House has a lot of exciting events coming up for a school visit this week. Could you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, we have a lot of events happening during school vacation week here. So starting on Tuesday, we have a special event for families called the Midnight Ride Storytelling Program. That one will be 11 to 12:30. And there's also one on Wednesday, 3 to 4:30, and Thursday, 10 to 11:30. And those are activities where families actually get to act out the story of the Midnight Ride themselves. So we walk through the Paul Revere House, we walk through the neighborhood following in Paul's footsteps, and each person gets to take on the role of someone involved in the story. And then we have other public events happening later. Rachel Revere will be here on Thursday the 19th at 1, 1:45, and 2:30 in the afternoon. So she'll be talking about what it felt like to have Paul be gone after the Midnight Ride and not come home and how worried she was. And then on Friday we have Henry Wadsworth Longfellow appearing from 1 to 4, and he's going to be having a drop-in poetry workshop for kids and others to come in and think about how he wrote poetry and how they could write their own poetry.
Great. Now, coming to the Paul Revere House for one of these activities, what is the age group that it's hitting, that it's aiming at?
A lot of our events are aimed at multiple age groups. So the Midnight Ride storytelling part is going to be really aimed at kids 6 to 10, but adults are expected to attend as well and are often welcome to participate. And the Rachel Revere and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, even our concert on next Saturday, which would be the 21st for Fife and Drum Concert, those are all for any age group, anybody, adults through kids and kids of all ages.
That actually leads me to my next question. What else do you have going on coming up for the rest of the season? We got a big season coming up this year.
Yeah, we do. Saturday the 21st, we have a concert, Fife and Drum Concert. And then in May, we start our weekly Saturday events, which are Paul Revere's Boston events. And we have them May through mid-October every Saturday afternoon. So they're a mix of tours, a mix of craft demonstrations and concerts and people portraying characters from the time period. So each Saturday is something different.
And I imagine there's a website you can find all that information at.
Yep, our website is www.paulreverehouse.org, and there's an events page that you can find on there.
Now, for the average visitor, what can you expect at a visit of the Paul Revere House?
It's a self-guided visit for families just happening along the trail or coming through Boston, and you come and see a house, which is the 1680 home that the Reveres bought in 1770, so it was an old house when they moved in. And there are four rooms that are open to the public. There's staff on each floor to answer questions, and the admission is very reasonable. It's $3.50 for adults and $1 for kids, and most of that goes to supporting the preservation of the house and the keeping it open as a museum. So we've been here as a museum since 1908. We're run by the Paul Revere Memorial Association.
And you have an expansion project coming this year too, right?
We do. We're about to start construction in June for a new building, new old building behind us, which is going to be our new education and visitor center. And that's we're hoping that will open in 2013 in the fall.
It's an ambitious project. Everyone's really excited about it. So.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
What about the Paul Revere House makes it so special? Obviously, Paul Revere lived here, but it's a pretty special site, even if he didn't.
It is. Well, as I always say that we're very lucky that Paul happened to buy such an old house because he, as I said, he purchased it in 1770 when it was 90 years old. So if he had bought a new house in 1770, we probably wouldn't have anything left over from the 1600s in downtown Boston. It was only saved because Paul lived in it. And he owned it for 30 years, but he was only one of hundreds of people who lived in this building. So we're really lucky that he happened to buy an old house and that it got preserved because he became famous. It was used very heavily. It was a boarding house for many years, so sailors living here who were working on the wharves nearby. Hundreds of people listed it as their address in the 1840 census. And then in the late 19th century, early 20th century, it was being used as stores, a grocery store, a bank, and then a cigar rolling factory. And there were 13 men living in the attic right before it was restored as a museum.
So in the museum, there's loads of great old stuff that, mm-hmm. you know, everyone should come see. It's wonderful, folks. Come see it. What's your favorite thing in there?
Oh, that's a really hard question. I think we're really lucky to have some Revere furniture. We have things that were handed down in the Revere family with the tradition of belonging to Paul and his wife, Rachel. So we have Rachel's sewing table. We have chairs that were used in their home. And we always have some Revere silver on display that he made. So we're lucky to be able to show those pieces so that people can get up close and look at them.
And are you guys involved with the other sites at all in doing any programs or events this year?
Yeah, we have lots of events happening with other sites. Right now, our curator is planning a special event that's happening on three Fridays. So actually, the first one is tomorrow, the 13th, but then there'll be one in May and one in June where the Downtown Historic House Museum Alliance, all the houses, the five houses have a correspondence special event. And so each house you can go to and visit and see letters that were written by the people there. So we're going to have our three Revere handwritten letters on display on those days. And that's a $20 ticket. We also have a special event happening in the end of April, so April 29th, which is a Sunday. There's going to be a special public event open to anybody on the Prado, the Paul Revere Mall in the North End, right by the Paul Revere statue. So it's an event in cooperation with the Old North Church, with the Cyrus Dallin Museum. It's all about Cyrus Dallin's 150th birthday. He's the sculptor of that statue, and we're having a big event that afternoon to celebrate.
So Paul Revere, the Paul Revere House is obviously an artifact in and of itself. Mm-hmm. So
our largest object.
Yeah, largest object. Why? How do you sell to people that if they can only get to a couple of things in Boston while they're here? There's so mm-hmm. much stuff. How do you convince them come to this little house?
Well, I think people are interested in it, especially because when you're walking through, especially if you're walking on the Freedom Trail, you don't run into any other historic houses that are open until you get to us, and we're the only house on the trail that's open to the public. So it's really a great experience to be able to picture not just Paul Revere, but lots of people living here in Boston during this exciting time in the, you know, revolutionary era, and see what it was like to live inside one of the houses here.
Why is preservation of sites like this so important? And sites like the Old South Meeting House and mm-hmm. Park Street Church, all of them, why is it so important to get people into them and let them see it?
I think it's a great way to see kind of our history and to sort of put yourself in the footsteps of people who lived here and try to imagine what it was like during that really, you know, exciting time period. I think if we didn't save any, if all the buildings like Paul Revere's house were torn down, then we wouldn't have any real sense of what it was like to live in Boston in earlier periods. So it's important to keep them so that people can go back and study them and learn more about our past.
Great, and hopefully they will this year. Thanks so much for your time, Emily. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for including me.
Visit the Paul Revere House in Boston's North End all year round. Find out more about Emily's programs this week and in the future at paulreverehouse.org. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Freedom Trail Podcast. Generous funding was provided by the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Learn more at massteachers.org. Paul Revere at Gunpoint was written by Sam Jones, creative director of the Freedom Trail Foundation, and performed by the Freedom Trail players, Melissa Walker, Rob Crean, Michael Costello, John Overby, and Josh Rudy. The script draws heavily from Paul Revere's Ride by David Hackett Fisher. Guests were Emily Holmes, education director of the Paul Revere House, and Jane Triber, independent scholar and author. Music was provided by the Middlesex County Volunteers Fifes and Drums. Visit them online at mcvfifesanddrums.org. This podcast was created by the Freedom Trail Foundation. Visit us online at thefreedomtrail.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Freedom Trail and become a fan of Freedom Trail Foundation on Facebook for history updates, This Day in History videos, and other exclusive content. You can email us with tips, questions, or anything else at info@thefreedomtrail.org. I'm your host, Matt Wilding.